Kenosha. Light rain with 61 degrees for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next. WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. In part one of today's morning show, a look at the genius who invented the Polaroid camera and the fierce battle which occurred in the courts when Kodak tried to encroach on that development. In part two of today's program, a look at the unconscious mind. And just a quick reminder that tomorrow on the morning show, we are delighted to welcome back into our studios Kate Jerome, who will be here to answer any of your questions about lawn and garden care. You are welcome to give us a call tomorrow during the program, or if you prefer to email your question ahead of time, feel free to send me an email, gberg@carthage.edu, gberg@carthage.edu, and I'll be happy to pass on your questions to Kate Jerome on tomorrow's program. And by the way, while we're looking ahead, Friday's morning show includes a conversation which I recorded in the heart of the beautiful Kenosha Theater in the heart of downtown Kenosha. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock and is archived at WGTD.org. If there is anything that people in modern America, throughout the world for that matter, tend to take entirely for granted, it is the notion of instant photography, of pointing your camera, your iPhone at something, pressing a button, and voila, there is the image forever captured. Once upon a time, and those of us who are old enough vividly remember this, you had a camera with film in it, and when that film was exhausted, you wound it up, you opened up your camera, you tucked it into an envelope, and you mailed it off, and you waited for those pictures to be developed and to be returned in the mail. And that was a whole different world. It feels like a different planet we're describing. And one of the geniuses who helped change the whole notion of photography is a man by the name of Edwin Land. And he helped develop the famous Polaroid camera and a brand new technology which utterly transformed people's understanding of photography and their expectations. But with the development of that spectacular new Polaroid camera came some real trouble in the form of various competitors encroaching on those important discoveries. And hence the stuff of a fascinating new book called A Triumph of Genius, Edwin Land, Polaroid, and the Kodak Patent War, in which we hear about the struggle for Edwin Land and the Polaroid company to fend off competition from Polaroid, from Kodak, with technology which they believed encroached upon their patents. And the author of this book is someone who was involved in that groundbreaking case, Ron Feirstein. He was a lawyer with the firm of Fish and Neve, representing Polaroid in that battle with Eastman Kodak. And Ron Feirstein, as a matter of fact, worked very closely with two of the most important witnesses on behalf of Polaroid, Dr. Edwin Land himself, as well as Howard Rogers. And so he has a very intimate understanding of this entire dispute and its significance. Since then, he has gone on to a career of representing a number of people in the recording and theater industries. And but has taken time out of that busy, interesting life to write this fascinating book, again called A Triumph of Genius, Edwin Land, Polaroid, and the Kodak Patent War. And Ronald Feirstein, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. How are you today?
Just fine. I am so happy to talk with you. A couple of times in the last year or so, for no particular reason, I have thought about the Polaroid camera. I so vividly remember our well-to-do relatives from Milwaukee coming to visit us in our little town in northeast Iowa, and my Uncle Carl having with him one of these spectacular Polaroid cameras, and at least the one he had, this would have been in the mid-60s, was, you know, now in my mind's eye, a huge contraption. But this notion of the picture, you pull it off, you peel this thing away, and you wait, and just within seconds, you actually see this image. It was like an astonishing miracle.
There's a great quote from Arthur Clarke, the famous science fiction writer, that says, he said back when, that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And I think that's exactly what you're touching on, Greg. This was a radical departure from the way photography had been done for more than 100 years, where you could hold the photograph in your hand just moments after pressing the shutter.
It was just extraordinary. And again, in some ways you feel like you were present when you saw your first automobile or something like that, when all you'd known before that was horse and buggy or stagecoaches or something.
Exactly.
I don't know, but it felt, in a sense, almost as revolutionary.
Well, you know, an interesting aspect, in your introduction, you talked about, you know, how people can take pictures with digital cameras these days or their phones, for example, and of course, that's true, but the big difference between that kind of instant photography, if you will, and the kind that Polaroid did was that with Polaroid, you actually held a print in your hand, and with the digital camera, of course, you have to show the photograph on the screen and otherwise, but it's not quite the same thing.
No, not exact. And I think it's also one of those instances in which now, of course, a Polaroid camera, it might as well be a butter churn in terms of its utter irrelevancy to our modern life. And yet, at some point in time, this was a spectacular innovation. And I think one of the interesting things about your book is that you help us understand the science behind this innovation, beyond the really interesting sort of legal battles which ensued. Talk for a moment, first of all, about Edwin Land himself. I wish we had longer to talk, because he is an extraordinarily fascinating figure who apparently from very early in his life was tremendously fascinated with light. Tell us more about that.
Well, he, as a young camper in a summer camp, a counselor demonstrated to the kids the phenomenon of polarization. Polarization, very simply, is the ability of some materials to be able to take the glare out of bright light. The only material that people knew about in those days, which were the 20s, were big pieces of crystal, big pieces of rock that could take the glare out of bright light. And Land, as a young man, and some of his friends, they immediately thought of all kinds of applications for a more practical material, so everything from sunglasses to camera filters to taking the glare out of automobile headlights. And so he committed himself to that. It became an obsession of his. He started experiments in high school. He went off to Harvard, but dropped out in his first year to pursue experiments to try and come up with a practical polarizer. And then at the age of 19 years old, he solved the problem. He found a way to create a very thin piece of plastic that had microscopic crystals embedded in it that could take the glare out of bright light. And from that, he was able to start his company, which became Polaroid, and your sunglasses of today, your LED screens, your polarizing filters on your cameras, so many, many applications use that technology that Edwin Land developed at the age of 19 back in the 20s.
Hmm. The prologue of your book talks about a moment in 1943. Describe to our listeners the event that you describe in your prologue?
Well, what happened was Land had built a $200 million company based upon this polarizer technology. A lot of the growth came from World War II, where they produced all kinds of devices for the military. But at the end of the war, as the war was winding down, he became concerned about the future of his company because he was never able to sell the polarizer to Detroit as a great idea. And so he thought, well, this is going to be a limited market for this invention. I need something else to apply my energies to and the energies of my company. And he was on vacation with his daughter. They were taking a walk in New Mexico, enjoying the light, snapping away, taking photographs. And when they were done and they were walking to the drugstore where he had to drop off the film to get it developed, his daughter started tugging on his pants and going, "Daddy, Daddy, I don't want to wait. I want to see the photographs now." And, you know, a lot of fathers would just dismiss a young kid complaining about that, but not Edwin Land. Edwin Land, it really sparked something in his mind, and he immediately set out to come up with a photography system, a revolutionary one, that would provide a photograph within moments after snapping the shutter.
Hmm. Tell us more about what was required to achieve this technological breakthrough, and just how radical a reshaping of the whole process was this? I mean, was he taking technology that already existed and just sort of shaping it and altering its process, or was this completely different from the kind of photography that had been done before?
Well, you know, Land used to say that all scientists and all inventors' work rests on the shoulders of those who went before them. And so I think that that is absolutely true, and it was true in this case. This technology is called diffusion transfer, and I don't want to get too technical for your audience, but basically you have a material in the negative which then transfers to a positive to create a picture based upon how that negative has been exposed. And it's called diffusion transfer in black and white. It's a silver colloid material that transfers in color. It's a dye. In fact, the same three color dyes that form the color pictures in your computer printer, cyan, yellow, and magenta. And Land started, there had been back into the 19th century some work in diffusion transfer, very simple diffusion transfer processes where a negative would transfer an image onto a piece of glass, or very rudimentary things. And Land started with that technology. But to take that technology to the level where you would have a sharp photograph within a minute was quite a lot of work and quite an undertaking. And he and his team were able to accomplish that in 4 years. So 1947, he was able to demonstrate for the first time the first one-step photographic system. It took sepia photographs. And in 1948, Polaroid put out the first commercial system, which also took sepia photographs. And later, they put out black and white film. And in 1963, they were able to introduce color film. But all of those were peel-apart systems. You know, when Land first conceived of this, he thought of a photograph that would just come out of the camera and develop in your hand. But that wasn't quite possible, and it took a lot of steps to get to that. So the early ones, as you mentioned before, had to be timed and then peeled apart, and then you'd have to cover the print with some kind of chemical to stabilize it, and if you wanted it to lay flat, you'd have to mount it on a piece of cardboard. It wasn't until 1972 that Polaroid put out a system where that really reflected Land's original dream, which was to have a photograph come out of the camera and just develop in your hands with no further action taken by the photographer. And that was called the SX-70, and that was truly revolutionary.
Right. That's even a more amazing development. Well, of course, this is the kind of spectacular breakthrough that had a company like Kodak, of course, really spooked. So tell us what Kodak ended up developing, which Polaroid regarded, it would seem quite rightly, as an encroachment on their own patents.
There are really two themes in my book. One is the story of Edwin Land, who's just the most amazing inventor, third on the list of U.S. inventors behind Thomas Edison that no one's ever heard of, and I just think his story needs to be told. But the other main story in my book is the relationship between Polaroid and Kodak over 60 years and how it went from mentor-protege to arch-enemies. It really is a story of almost operatic dimension. Polaroid would not have succeeded without Kodak's help. Kodak was instrumental at every step of the way in the early days. Kodak was the first customer for Land's polarizing material back in 1934. They bought the equivalent of $100,000 of that thin plastic that they turned into camera filters. When Land decided to start those experiments we talked about in photography, who did he turn to for the materials? His friends at Kodak. They gave him paper and chemicals and all kinds of things to work with, even though they had no idea what he was doing. And later, when he came up with the final product, he realized that his company couldn't manufacture the negative, so he engaged Kodak to manufacture the negatives for Polaroid film. And in fact, Kodak manufactured the negatives for every Polaroid film from the very beginning in the 40s well into the 1960s. And by the mid-1960s, Polaroid was Kodak's second largest corporate customer, second only to the cigarette manufacturers for whom Kodak made those small white plastic tubes they turned into cigarette filters. So these two companies had a long and mutually beneficial relationship and were very close. Everything changed, though, in 1968 when Land showed the prototype of what was to become SX-70 to his friends at Kodak. For the first time, Kodak looked at that and said, wow, this might be the thing that challenges our domination of amateur photography. Because up to that point, when instant photography was peel apart, Kodak really looked at it as a curiosity, as a niche, you know, and they were happy to be a supplier of the negative. But when they saw this picture that emerged from the camera and didn't require any other work and just developed in front of your eyes, they got nervous. And they said to Land at that point, listen, we'll help you with this new film like we did with the others, but only if you let us manufacture some and sell it in our own yellow boxes. Polaroid couldn't accept that. They didn't think they could compete. And so at that point, the two companies went their separate ways. Polaroid went off to learn how to manufacture its own negative. Kodak went off to figure out how to compete with Polaroid in this field. And it wasn't until 1976, 4 years after Polaroid put out SX-70, that Kodak came out with its own system. Up until that point, no one at Polaroid, including Dr. Land, knew what Kodak was going to come out with. You have to realize Kodak was the most formidable photographic research company on the planet, and so they were fully capable of leapfrogging Polaroid's technology and coming up with something radically better. But in fact, when they came out in 1976 with their system, it really was not radically better, and in fact, it incorporated several aspects of Polaroid's technology, and from that came probably the most important patent technology lawsuit of the 20th century.
Hmm. And we only have a couple of minutes to talk about that process, but I wonder for the average layman, if you could just give a sense of what the nuts and bolts of such disputes tend to be. I mean, when one is working through whether or not, in fact, a company like Kodak has encroached upon the patent of a company like Polaroid, what specifics are examined and in what way to arrive at a determination?
Well, it's pretty simple. You know, a patent covers an invention. And our patent system says that if you invent something and you disclose it to the world by publishing it in a patent, you can have a monopoly in that invention for a limited period of time, which at the time was 17 years. After the 17 years, it becomes available for everybody to use, but you have your limited 17-year monopoly in your invention. So when someone uses your invention without your permission, you sue them for it's called infringing your patent because they're using your invention. So the first thing you have to prove is that they're indeed using your invention. So you can prove that by just comparing the product they put out with the invention disclosed in your patent, and you make that connection. The other main contention people who are accused of infringement make is that the patent is no good in the first place. Because even though the patent office may give you a patent, it's not fully determinative forever. And someone can challenge that patent and say, no, patent office was wrong. They shouldn't have granted a patent because the invention disclosed isn't really an invention. Because there is a qualitative, quantitative level that you have to reach in order to be entitled to an invention. It has to be new. It has to be unobvious to others who are skilled in your art, and so on. So Kodak was said, in some cases, we didn't use your invention, Polaroid, and in other cases, they said, well, Polaroid, the patent you're suing us on is invalid because it shouldn't have been issued in the first place, because the invention disclosed really doesn't rise to the level that warrants a patent.
Hmm. I noticed in your biography that you work directly with two of Polaroid's main witnesses, Dr. Edwin Land and Howard Rogers, during what's called the discovery phase of the litigation process. What was that like for you?
Well, that was a tremendous experience. In fact, I worked with them both through the trial. I wrote the outline for Dr. Land's and Howard Rogers' testimony at the trial, and worked with them through the entire process. And it was fascinating because they were both wonderful gentlemen, incredibly intelligent. Dr. Land was a bit imperious, and some people saw him as harsh and difficult. Many of his employees were scared to death of him. But really, if you got to know him and if he respected you, he was warm, and I will forever be grateful for the fact that he let me work with him and tolerated my efforts, if you will, to learn a technology that he knew about. He knew more about than anybody on the planet, and I was frantically trying to learn this technology and frame it for him in the context of the lawsuit issues. And I really appreciated the fact that he somehow found that, my help to be worthwhile and let me work with him. And at the end of the trial, he actually autographed one of his patents for me, and I have it framed and proudly hanging on my office wall.
Hmm. The book, again, is called A Triumph of Genius, Edwin Land, Polaroid, and the Kodak Patent War, published by Ankerweich, and the author, Ronald Feirstein. Ronald Feirstein, congratulations on a really, really fascinating book. I appreciate the care with which it is written, and I'm so glad we got to talk about it today. Thank you so much.
Greg, thanks for having me.
And the time now is 8:32, and you're listening to the morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. Here's part two. We're going to be probing into the unconscious today, and maybe more specifically, trying to better understand just what we mean when we talk about sort of those often hidden and obscured layers of the human experience. That is, what we are thinking and feeling and experiencing just beneath the surface, and often forces and feelings and prejudices and all kinds of attitudes which can actually drive so many of the actions we take and the decisions we make, and in ways that often are very much beyond immediate comprehension and certainly beyond our immediate notice. That's at least part of a really fascinating book called What You Don't Know, You Know, Our Hidden Motives in Life, Business, and Everything Else. The author is Dr. Ken Isehold, who is a practicing psychoanalyst, and he has written a book that is a very, very intriguing look at how we are put together mentally and emotionally, and in particular this notion of the conscious and the unconscious, and of how perhaps we need to be understanding the notion of the unconscious in perhaps a more complex and nuanced way, that it is not a simple duality of one thing on top and another thing on the bottom, but in fact we are creatures with many more layers than that and a rich complexity, which is endlessly interesting to those who study such things. Again, the book is called What You Don't Know, You Know. It's published by Other Press. And Dr. Ken Isehold, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's good to be here, Greg. Thank you.
I do look forward to this very much. Maybe we could talk for a moment about something I just very briefly touched on, and that is how perhaps once upon a time there was a rather simplistic dualism with which people understood the notion of the conscious and the unconscious. And, of course,
right.
Once upon a time, people didn't even think in that much complexity. So the notion of a conscious and an unconscious was, of course, a tremendous breakthrough when it occurred just over 100 years ago. But you are calling now for us to think about conscious and unconscious thought and feeling in a more complex fashion than that.
Absolutely. Obviously, you've been reading my book, and I appreciate that, right? I think it's true that, you know, Freud is so generally credited with sort of discovering or inventing or publicizing the unconscious. And he had this idea that it was helpful to understand sort of extreme emotional kind of conflicts, that what was relegated to the unconscious were things that people couldn't bear to think about consciously. So they were like sort of sexual impulses or highly aggressive impulses that people had. So they were, he used the term, they were repressed. They were like banished, you know. And so like you, it took a lot of effort to get back in touch with this. I think that he's not wrong about that, but that's a very small percentage, you know, of what's going on in the unconscious. I think we're thinking about it differently these days. People who studied the brain know, for example, according to one view, we process about, or we receive about 11 million bits of information from our senses every second. And we only have the capacity to actually process 40 of those, 40 out of 11 million. So how do we handle that? It seems to me what we do, the brain, is organized to have a basically a set of templates where things that fit in, that are particularly important, get processed. But mostly that's to kind of make sure that we're living in a familiar world, that the world has held up and continues to be what we think it is. And the rest gets discarded. You know, the occasional odd bit of information that alerts us to a danger that we hadn't expected, sometimes that gets through. But usually we're sort of scanning the world just to make sure it's there in the way that's familiar, predictable, and, you know, how we originally encountered it. Hmm. And so basically it's normal. The unconscious is a normal aspect of things that we don't process, but the information is available if we stop this looking for what's familiar. Hmm.
One of the things you mentioned is that the term unconscious, talking about the unconscious, is surprisingly, or maybe not so surprisingly, absent from so much literature in the whole realm of psychotherapy, that evidently to talk about the conscious in so many words might lead you to be associated with, for instance, as a follower of Freud or a practitioner in psychoanalysis. But you're suggesting that to not talk about the subconscious at all, to not speak about it frankly and openly is a mistake, no matter what kind of psychotherapy you practice or whatever your needs might be.
That's absolutely true. I do think the word unconscious sort of has a kind of, people have a prejudice against it because it is so associated with Freud and with psychoanalysis. And this old idea I was talking about before of repression, you know, the notion the unconscious is really all about our desires to kill our fathers and sleep with our mothers and things like that. But I think, as I'm saying, it's much bigger than that. And the reason it's coming back is because more and more people are discovering that it's there. Now, we can't afford to just discard these things just because we don't want to believe in them. It happens to be very true. And so even the behaviorists, you know, the psychologists who didn't want to think about anything but what we've actually learned, what's logical, what's cognitively clear, they're just beginning to discover that there's so much about human behavior that is out of awareness, and so they're bringing it into their work as well. It's an idea, its time has come back.
One of the things you talk about in the first portion of the book is sort of the modern self, about sort of the stress with which so many of us seem to be living, with acute feelings of vulnerability and fragility in a lot of Looks like we're having some technical difficulties with the recording of this particular interview. Please stand by. We'll see if we can loosen things up. Just one moment, please. The time is 8:40. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. Doesn't look like our interview is going to come back. My apologies. We'll have something else to finish out the hour in just a moment. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD. Again, the name of that interview, the name of that book, which we were not able to, the interview of which we were not able to complete, is What You Don't Know, You Know. And the author, Dr. Ken Isehold, E-I-S-O-L-D. It's 8:42. I guess we need to do something else to finish out today's morning show here on WGTD. Just a quick reminder while we're stopped that tomorrow's morning show will feature Kate Jerome, who's from the Horticulture Department here at Gateway Technical College, joining us as she does from time to time through the spring and summer months to answer any questions that you might have about lawn or garden care. So please make a point of listening tomorrow to the morning show, preferably to phone in your questions to Kate Jerome. If you prefer to email your questions ahead of time, your email questions are welcome at gberg@carthage.edu. Here's part two of part three of today's program here on WGTD. Well, if you care about food and what you eat and why you eat it and why as a culture we look at food the way we do, then I really urge you to read a fascinating book called The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. And perhaps you know the name Michael Pollan, best-selling author, for a previous book which he wrote called The Botany of Desire. And Pollan has written for many, many years for New York Times Magazine and is a professor of journalism at Berkeley. And you can find out more about him at michaelpollan.com. And in this new book called Omnivore's Dilemma, we found out a lot about we as human beings and our sort of insatiable urge to eat and what draws us to particular foods and the role that food plays in our lives. It really gets you thinking about something that we tend to sort of take for granted or only appreciate on sort of a surface level. So I'm very excited indeed for the next few minutes to have this chance to speak with author Michael Pollan. Michael Pollan, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thanks, Greg. Good to be here.
So at what point in your life did food become so important to you, and maybe even more than that, writing about food so perceptively?
Well, yeah, I hadn't started out as a food writer, and I'm really a writer who is very interested in nature and writing about our relationship to the natural world. And somewhere along the line, I'd written books on gardening and design and drugs and plants. And somewhere along the line, I realized that our most profound engagement with nature comes at the end of a fork. It really, what we put on our plates is how we interact with other species and the land, and do more to change the land and the composition of species on the planet than any other single thing we do. Though we don't see it when we're sitting down to eat, when we're having a hamburger at McDonald's or a home-cooked meal from the farmer's market, we don't really always understand that that's what's at stake here. And, you know, all species can be defined by their place in a food chain. When we study any other species, we look at what does it eat and what eats it. And where we fit into the food chain has a lot to do with defining ourselves. So that really, you know, I, as a writer interested in these areas, I knew that sooner or later food was a big fat topic I had to take up.
And of course, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and so there it was. I plunged into it and realized that it was the most fascinating topic I had yet encountered.
Well, and of course, you are taking it on now, particularly in this book, at a moment in time when the way we look at food seems to be reshaped in so many profound and in some cases troubling ways.
I think that's true. I think that food is emerging as a very important issue. It's a health issue. It's an environmental issue. It's a climate change issue. And people are suddenly really, you know, engaging in a conversation about the American way of eating and understanding, I think, that there's something profoundly dysfunctional about the American way of eating right now.
In fact, the very first page of your book has the word absurdity, and you're using pretty strong language there to describe what seems to be a new array of attitudes in place in which, in your words, we seem to need investigative journalists to tell us where our food comes from and nutritionists to determine our dinner menu. I mean, the way we approach what you call this very basic question of what should we have for dinner has changed so much.
Well, if you think about it, you know, for thousands of years, humans have figured out what to eat without a lot of expert help. And suddenly we find ourselves in this position where we're listening to journalists and to nutritionists and to doctors to decide what really is a kind of fundamental creaturely question: what should we have for dinner? And one of the things I set out to answer in Omnivore's Dilemma is why did it get so complicated? And part of the reason, and it occurred to me too at a certain point, that a book that tried to figure out where our food comes from is not a book that you could have written 100 years ago, because everybody knew where their food came from. You wouldn't pay to read a book to find out something as ordinary. It'd
right.
be like buying a book on how to breathe.
Well, even if the book were free, you wouldn't bother
invest the time. But of course, now we don't know where our food comes from. Children, you know, have no idea. I tell a story about being online at McDonald's, and there's a girl asking about where do hamburgers come from, and her dad says they come from cows, and she says, "Oh, like milk." And, well, it's not exactly like milk.
I want to ask especially about a moment in the introduction when you talk about the lack of a steadying culture of food leaves us especially vulnerable to the blandishments of the food scientists and the marketer, for whom the omnivore's dilemma is not so much a dilemma as an opportunity. What exactly do you mean there by the lack of a steadying culture of food here in the United States?
Well, for most of history, and you still find this if you go to other countries with a really vibrant food culture, I'm thinking of countries like Italy or France, the decision about what to eat is really determined by your cultural environment. And culture is really just a fancy word for your mother. I mean, you know, when it comes to food, basically mothers for most of history have determined what you're going to eat, how much of it you're going to eat, what you're going to eat it with, who you're going to eat it with, and that, you know, you didn't have to make a whole lot of decisions. People, the force of tradition and habit basically determined the dinner menu. And if you look at our culture, though, things have changed a lot. Odds are that you do not eat the same food that your mother ate as a child. And she may not even eat the same food she ate as a child, where there's this incredible amount of churn going on in the American diet. And that is partly because historically we've never had a really strong culture of food, because we're an immigrant nation made up of lots of different cultures, none of which kind of dominated. I mean, I suppose English more than any, but that's not too great when it comes to food. So as a result, we are really vulnerable to outside influences, whether that is, and usually that takes the form of food marketers, companies coming along and selling us on new foods. That, you know, you should eat fast food, or you should eat, you know, gourmet food, or whatever is on sale at the supermarket. And so we change the way we eat more than most people do. Historically, you know, a food, what a culture eats is one of the hardest things to shake about it. And if you go to an immigrant's home, the last place to look for signs of assimilation are the refrigerator and the pantry.
That's where people hold on to their roots the most intently and determinedly.
But we're losing that. We're really losing those roots. And that's really unfortunate, because culture has a lot of wisdom when it comes to food. What people have eaten for a long time tends to be healthy, because people wouldn't remain, you know, healthy eating that, and they would stop eating it. And most traditional cuisines, you know, whatever the one it is, whether it's Asian or European or African, tend to be good ways to eat, and far better ways to eat than the Western diet that most of us have adopted, which is a very novel diet, and we're learning is making people very sick.
We're speaking with Michael Pollan, and we're talking about his fascinating new book called The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. I do want to get into the balance of the book, but one other thing in the introduction I just think has to be talked about, because this is the kind of thing that we so take for granted. You talk about the ways in which human beings are different from most of nature's other eaters. You say markedly so, in the way that we modify the food chains we depend on by means of such revolutionary technologies as cooking with fire, hunting with tools, farming, and preserving food. I mean, it's just so funny to think of those things as revolutionary technologies, because they've been with us for so long that we've forgotten all about the way in which they reshaped the whole act of eating.
Tremendously. I mean, we've had several revolutions in eating, and you're right to say that cooking was one of the first, and that was a huge deal, because it gave us a tremendous edge over other creatures. We could eat things they couldn't eat because we knew how to cook them. Something like various tubers that are poisonous if they're raw, when we learned we could cook them, things like potatoes, suddenly we had this, you know, vast store of new nutritional stuff, and that allowed us to grow. And cooking also makes food much more digestible. And there are anthropologists who believe that the growth of the human brain really begins when we can cook and unlock that storehouse of protein, fat, and carbohydrate. And then you have the invention of agriculture, too, where we moved from being hunter-gatherers and settled down and started growing food, and that had a tremendous effect. Not all good, by the way. It was really bad for our health. In a way, it was sort of like the coming of fast food more recently, that this whole new diet made people sick for a long time, partly because we were keeping animals. We started picking up diseases from them, but also because we weren't that good at farming, and we would run out of food and have these famines, or we'd eat too much of one thing, like all potatoes or all wheat, and suffer nutritional deficiencies. We were actually much healthier as hunter-gatherers. And so there was this initial period. In fact, we're just regaining our stature, our physical stature we had before the birth of agriculture. We sort of shrunk and got weaker with the birth of agriculture, and now we're coming back to where we were as hunter-gatherers in terms of our physical stature. And now we're having another revolution right now, and I think that is a big part of the problem that you're seeing, is that we've changed our diet more in the last 100 years than we have in the previous 1,000 since the birth of agriculture. And one of the ways we've done this is doing things like refining grain into white flour, making sugar, pure sugar, and making that common and available, these kind of transformations have had a profound effect on our biology, and they're the reason that we're getting fat and suffering from diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, diseases that really are not common in people eating a more traditional diet.
Hmm. What's kind of odd, it seems to me a kind of a strange dichotomy in the situation, is that on the one hand, you have a lot of us, I'm one of them, that spend a little too much time in drive-thrus and eating fast food on the run, this and that. In fact, you quote a statistic in your book someplace about how many American meals are eaten in one's car. Eaten in one's car.
20% of our eating takes place in the car right now.
So there are a whole lot of us that are rather careless about what we eat, and we gravitate towards all these things that are not particularly good for us. But on the other hand, you also open up your book with you know, sort of expressing frustration at sort of the kind of irrational ways in which some people are trying to be very careful about what they eat, but to the point of absurdity where people stop eating bread or stop eating other central staples in our diet. I mean, does that strike you as well as kind of a strange, two-sided situation?
It's part of our dysfunction as eaters. I mean, in the same way that we don't have this steadying food culture, it leaves us vulnerable to these food fads. And we do, you know, we all say we want to eat healthily, and we're great consumers of health information about food. And so
some people do. I mean, some people don't care much about that at all.
Well, that's true. There are people who just go ahead and eat whatever they want to eat. But there is a large population in America that when a new study comes out saying, you know, we should be more worried about carbohydrates than fat, suddenly you've got millions of Americans shopping in a whole new way, and the supermarket has to completely revise what they're selling, and suddenly you've got low-carb beer and low-carb everything, and they're reformulating the pasta and the bread, and donut businesses go out of business, and bakeries go out of business. So, you know, the food industry is at the mercy of these food fads, and they come and go, and there's always that new diet. And right now, you know, the carbohydrate is being demonized, and fat is being rehabilitated. And, yeah, there are people who aren't paying attention to that, but there are a whole lot of people who are. And it really does get kind of crazy. I talk in the book about what I call the American paradox, that you've got a population that worries more about health and food than just about anyone on the earth, but is one of the least healthy eaters on the earth.
Yeah, there it is, and the word paradox is a great term. I'm reminded of the chef Julia Child, who would say that, I mean, she was tremendously healthy and lived a long, long life, and she just enjoyed a bountiful array of different kinds of food, and as far as she was concerned, that's the only way to eat, and the only way to eat healthfully.
Well, you know, you can eat a lot of food, and you can eat a lot of different things, but she was eating real food, you know. She was eating food made from raw ingredients, stuff, you know, products of nature, not industry. And my guess is she was not eating a whole lot of fast food. I probably would have, you know, not satisfied her palate. But, you know, you look at the French. I mean, that's the classic example. I mean, these are people who really enjoy their victuals and eat lots of saturated fat and drink lots of red wine. And guess what? They're healthier than we are.
Michael Pollan, and this is an excerpt from an interview which we did several years ago about one of his best-known books called The Omnivore's Dilemma. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a reminder that I'll be joined in the studio by Kate Jerome from the Horticulture Department here at Gateway Technical College. Kate will be here to answer your questions about your lawn and your garden. So please make a point of listening, and if you possibly can, calling in with your question to Kate Jerome on tomorrow's morning show. And on Friday's program, you'll hear the interview which I recorded yesterday from the heart of one of the most beautiful, interesting structures in downtown Kenosha, but a structure that many of you have never seen, the Kenosha Theater. And you'll hear that conversation on Friday's morning show. WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu.